From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. I'm filling in for Terry Gross for a couple of days. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I'll speak with Academy Award-winning film director William Friedkin. He's made some of Hollywood's most talked-about films, among them The French Connection, The Exorcist, and To Live and Die in L.A. Also today, I speak with Alan Beck, director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society. He investigates the curious and complex relationship between people and their pets. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the cast recording of John Adams' opera Nixon in China. And we'll have a number from blues singer Roscoe Brown. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is William Friedkin. In 1971, he received an Academy Award as Best Director for his film The French Connection. He also earned the reputation as one of the most accomplished directors of action movies in Hollywood. The French Connection had gritty dialogue, spectacular car chases, and vividly portrayed a world on the street shared by dangerous criminals and overzealous, eccentric cops.
You ever been to Poughkeepsie? Huh? Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie?
Hey, man, come on, give me a break. Hey,
what you talking about, man? Let me hear you say it. Come on. Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie? You've been to Poughkeepsie, haven't you? I want to hear it. Come on.
Yes, I've been.
You've been there, right?
Yeah.
You sat on the edge of the bed, didn't you? You took off your shoes, put your finger between your toes, and picked your feet, didn't you? Now say it.
Yes.
All right. You put a shoe on my partner. You know what that means? All winter long, I got to listen to him gripe about his bowling scores. Now, I'm going to bust your ass for those three bags, and I'm going to nail you for picking your feet in Poughkeepsie.
2 years later, Friedkin returned with The Exorcist, a terrifying movie about satanic possession. Friedkin's other films include To Live and Die in L.A., The Boys in the Band, and Cruising, a controversial movie about homosexuals. Gay groups picketed the film, protesting its seamy, violent portrayal of sadistic gay sex and gay lifestyles. Cat Squad, Python Wolf, Friedkin's latest project, is a made-for-TV action-adventure movie about an elite government team which combats international terrorism. Cat Squad airs on Monday night on NBC. I spoke with William Friedkin earlier today and asked him what he finds so interesting about the criminal world.
My uncle was a famous police officer in Chicago. My uncle was the man who brought in Frank Nitti, actually captured Frank Nitti. And it turned out, while I was growing up and listening to stories about my uncle, at a certain point, the rest of the family learned that my uncle was actually on the take. He was actually being paid by Frank Nitti while he was a Chicago policeman. After my uncle brought Frank Nitti in, he was taken off the Chicago Police Department and made a bodyguard. He was made the bodyguard to Frank Cermak, who was the mayor of Chicago in the early 30s. And he was with Mayor Cermak in Florida when an anarchist named Gus Zangara stood up at the Democratic Convention and took a shot at Franklin Roosevelt, who was being nominated, and missed Roosevelt but killed Mayor Cermak. And that was sort of the end of my uncle's career as a bodyguard. But all the time that I was growing up, I used to meet a lot of his cronies and a lot of the people on the other side of the law. My uncle owned a tavern after he retired from the police department and the bodyguard business. And I used to hang around that tavern when I was a kid and picked up a lot of stories and, I guess, a lot of impressions.
You describe him as both a fascinating and a frightening man for you. And I know for young children that there are often people in their lives who make this great impression on them, and it's an impression that they really carry with them for the rest of their lives.
Exactly. That is my strongest memory of youth, hanging around my uncle's tavern and listening to stories about the old Chicago Police Department. Then he had this extraordinary apartment, you know, with major appliances and stuff, which was way beyond the reach of the rest of the family. We were all very poor growing up there. My mother and father, may they rest in peace, they were Russian immigrants. And the rest of the family, as I say, was not doing that well. But my Uncle Harry was a champ, you know. So I was fascinated by his world and the contradictions in it.
Well, I know in your characters that they're, whether they're good guys or bad guys, that they're ambiguous characters, and they're many shades of gray. And I'm wondering whether you think there's something about the criminal world that blurs that distinction between what is good or who is good and who is evil. Because I think certainly cops and criminals share the same world. They understand each other very well.
Exactly. Some of the most interesting, fascinating people that I've ever known are on the other side of the law. They're frankly on the other side of the law. And yet, if you didn't know that, if I were to introduce them to you or to any member of my family, they would be very charming, very good with children, very vulnerable and emotional. And yet there is that other side. That has sort of been the theme of most of the films I've made, the thin line between the policeman and the criminal.
I think another theme is a kind of hypocrisy that many people have, that they profess to do good, but they break the law in the name of good, and the kind
exactly.
of hypocrisy that's involved in that.
Yes. And I guess I'm attracted to stories and characters that reflect that. That's as good a description of it as I've heard.
You grew up in Chicago, as you said, and you grew up in, I imagine, a kind of poor neighborhood, perhaps even a tough neighborhood. Were you a street kid? Were you a tough kid?
I don't think I was a tough kid, no. I mean, I would like to, carry along that sense of bravado. I was fascinated by what went on. I was pretty much on the fringes of most of the activity, although I was probably slated for trouble if it wasn't destroying my mother so much, and if I hadn't noticed what my own behavior was doing, I probably would be in jail right now. A lot of my friends were. But I never had the soul of a tough guy, frankly. Without much education, I still had aspirations towards something else. For a long time, I wanted to play basketball, and did. Played street basketball. But I try to avoid getting into fights and all that. You know, a lot of it was inevitable.
Well,
I certainly had a few, but I by no means was a tough guy or a gang member or anything like that.
Did you have trouble with the law? I mean, I think many kids, for instance, shoplift. That's not such an unusual childhood occupation. Was that something
yeah.
that you did?
Oh, yeah. Sure. I used to rob department stores and stuff like that.
Did you like the adventure of that?
It was simply adventure, and I must say that I really, as I think back on it, there was a long period in my life when I just didn't know right from wrong.
Hmm.
Honestly, did not. It wasn't that there were no values for me to pick up on in my parents' apartment, but the more pronounced values and the ones that made the greatest impact on me were those of peer group.
You said
it was a pretty tough neighborhood. It was tough. The only escape from that kind of violence was through sports.
And you were pretty good at those?
Not bad.
I played
basketball, and I used to play every day. Played at high school, but I would play all the time. And summer, winter, indoor, outdoor, Christmas Eve, New Year's Day, I'd play a lot of basketball.
My guest is Academy Award-winning film director William Friedkin. I think you make movies for men, and I think that the women who go to your movies are brought by their men friends or their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
And that you make movies, first of all, I think that the central characters are usually two men pitted against each other in one way or another. And they have the things that I think men are most interested in, which is car chases and action and a little sex and murder and fights and violence.
Well, you know, I guess that's a pretty accurate description of them. It's not conscious. I sort of get interested in stories like that, although I've done a wide variety of films. I haven't made that many. I think I've made 9 or 10 films, but among them is The Night They Raided Minsky's.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first film I made was a little piece with Sonny and Cher called Good Times. It was the first film that Sonny and Cher made. And then But I guess you're right. The films I'm known for could be said to be described the way that you've described them. Believe me, it isn't conscious. I'm not more interested in men. You know, in America, to be a filmmaker, you pretty much you do basically what you can do. It's not like the European cinema for the most part. It's very difficult to be able to go out as an American filmmaker and do a personal film and get it financed by anyone. There are exceptions, of course. There are a handful of exceptions. But even as I think of the work of these very iconoclastic filmmakers, so much of their recent work falls into a genre as well, or attempts to be commercial but on a lower budget. And so the kind of things that people tend to ask me to direct or are willing to direct when I say I'd like to make a film tend to be the kind of films that you've described. They're not necessarily the kind of films that I go to or that I prefer.
Are you then typecast as a director?
Probably. You know, in Elia Kazan's book, his new book, which I highly recommend to you and your audience, it's the best book I've ever read about the process of directing for film or the stage and about the inner life of a director. And it's so candid and honest and wonderful, beautifully written. Kazan, at a certain point in that book, says there are directors in Hollywood who are said to be able to do anything. They can be comedies, dramas, musicals, westerns. These directors can do anything. Kazan says he doesn't think that's very good. He says that the very best artists throughout history in whatever field do basically one thing, have basically one theme. He cites examples of, you know, Goya, for example, and Stravinsky, and a wide variety of examples from the other arts, of artists who basically are known for a single theme or a single kind of body of work. And he finds that more interesting in filmmaking than he does the work of somebody who can do anything.
Well, one thing that you are known for are your chase sequences, and certainly in The French Connection, that I would think unparalleled ride of terror that you filmed is really, I don't think anyone has quite surpassed that. And I'd be interested in knowing how you set that scene up, how you played that scene.
Well, you know, they're very hard to do. It's among the hardest things to film, to first of all do something different, second, be able to realize it, because they're so very difficult to film without getting somebody injured, and third, to get an idea that is completely different from any other chase, because there's so many being done now.
That's right.
The French Connection chase, though, grew out of the character, the principal nature of the Gene Hackman character, Popeye Doyle, his obsessiveness. And I was very conscious at the time I set that chase up, because I really didn't have an idea for it until about 2 weeks before the film started. I was aware of the chase in Bullet that had preceded French Connection by a few years. I felt that I had to do something better than Bullet if I was going to do something in that vein at all. So in looking at Bullet, I could see certain flaws in it. I could see, for example, that they cleared the streets every time they made a shot. The streets of San Francisco were basically used as you would use a soundstage or a movie set. They were totally free of any outside no other people on the streets, just the principals. So I thought, well, this would be one very good thing, is to have innocent people around, to have this chase going on in the middle of the day, in the middle of New York. In this case, it was Brooklyn or the Coney Island, a lot of it, and then various parts of Queens were cut in. But I thought, have people on the streets, have life going on, innocent bystanders, and work the chase into that so that there is a danger taking place to just these innocent people. Then I thought, you know, I could never top the movement of the two cars in Bullet. Hmm. So I have to get something else. What? What is intrinsic to Manhattan? What is intrinsic to this neighborhood? What can I work into this thing that will vary this from one car chasing another? And I used to ride the subways, and still do, in New York. And it occurred to me, yes, let's have a car chasing a train. Then I had to go out and find out how fast a train could go at its fastest if it, let's say, had been commandeered, as we portrayed it. And I found out that at its fastest speed, the train could only go 50 miles an hour.
Hmm.
So this made it then theoretically possible for a car starting several blocks behind to catch up with a train. Then everything was very meticulously choreographed. I rehearsed everything before I shot it. But then accidents happened. Certain things went wrong.
There was a real accident.
Nobody got hurt. But things did not go as I planned them 100%. But I was able to keep the accidents, in other words, keep the mistakes. And I think it's the mistakes in it, the rough edges, that really make it. Also, the use of sound, Marty. That chase, I always let people come in and look at my dailies with me, you know, the rushes. I don't mind people seeing rushes and stuff. And nobody was very impressed with the rushes of that chase. If you had just seen it before it was edited and then before the sound went in, you wouldn't have expected it to become, a great scene. It really is the juxtaposition of sound and the dynamic use of sound that's as powerful as the images.
I'm talking with Academy Award-winning film director William Friedkin. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is film director William Friedkin. His films include The Exorcist, The French Connection, and To Live and Die in L.A. His latest work is a made-for-TV action-adventure film. It's titled Cat Squad, Python Wolf, and airs on NBC this Monday night. The French Connection got 5 Academy Awards, including for Best Director, Best Picture, Best Actor. Do you think it's your best film?
No. I think the filmmaking in The Exorcist is better. A film I made that did not do very well is actually, I think, is the most important film I've made, and that's Deal of the Century, which was roundly roasted by most of the critics. But I thought it was important and funny. I don't think it's fully realized. You know, I don't think it's perfect, and I don't think it's as well directed as it could be, because the script was brilliant. The script was just first rate, and I don't think I did as good with it as I might have. It wasn't intentional, but I think it's still a very important film, an important comedy about the arms race.
Well, you describe The Exorcist as a film about the mystery of faith and no more, and I would say that people going to see the movie The Exorcist would say it's a horror film. And
I never thought of it as a horror film. Still don't. I don't think it in any way fits into the category. First of all, The Exorcist was about an actual event, which has now resurfaced in the papers recently. The actual event briefly took place in Washington, or in the Silver Spring, Maryland area in 1949. It was widely reported in the Washington Post then, and it involved a 14-year-old boy who was not from a Catholic family, but had these strange things happening to him, and was very, very sick and not diagnosable in any medical sense. And so through a series of circumstances, his family took him to the Alexian Brothers Hospital in St. Louis, where an exorcism was performed on this young man. And I was able to see the diaries of not only the priests involved in that exorcism, but the doctors and nurses who were in attendance. And they're quite stunning, quite eye-opening. They're in the archives at Georgetown, and I had access to them. And I realized when I saw these documents that this story had resonance way, way beyond anything like a horror story or just a work of fiction. It had implications that were far deeper and greater. And I tried to make the film with those implications in mind. There are no like crude effects in it. I specifically attempted to take those out. It's not like a Hammer film of an Edgar Allan Poe piece or something. It also, The Exorcist is a very well-written piece. I think it stands up.
See, I think it is both what you say and also what the audience says, because I think in certain ways it describes the horror the doubt casts on our faith, and that it is about good and evil, which I think are elements that you play with, and that the horror has to do with a world that perhaps we don't understand, or a world where evil and goodness are in battle, and that we're in somehow peril because of that.
Oh, yes. But, I mean, it isn't about some monster stalking the streets with a knife. You know, it's not a slasher movie.
No.
It's not a vampire film. It's not a, it doesn't fit into any of the categories of horror pictures. It is like a realistic film about inexplicable things. Now, I know it's called a horror film. I mean, and it's won awards from horror film festivals and stuff like that. But it isn't that I don't like horror films either, but that mantle does not wear well to either Bill Blatty, who wrote it, or to me. We had far more serious things in mind. But it was meant to be a film that would be seen by a lot of people. You know, I've seen equally powerful films that dealt with, you know, the mystery of faith and the inexplicable that no one ever saw, like Carl Dreyer's Vampire or Debt, which is one of the greatest films I've ever seen, you know, about literal resurrection.
Vincent Canby, in the film critic for the New York Times, talked about a movie you did called Cruising, and he talked about it. The words he used was a homosexual horror film, and it's the story of a policeman who goes undercover to catch a killer who's been murdering members of a sadomasochistic gay community. And he suffers from a sort of identity crisis because of having to kind of put on a persona that he doesn't know much about. There were many protests about the film, and many felt that you portrayed gays in a bad light. Do you see this as an anti-homosexual film?
Not at all. I'm very much in sympathy with the gay rights movement, you know, actively and passively sympathetic to it. The portrayal of the gay world in Cruising was a background, nothing more. It was a background for a murder mystery, and it was not meant to make a comment or a statement about gay life. In fact, I believe there's a disclaimer on the front of the film that says that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. It was simply meant as a background, a kind of exotic background, in the sense that no one had seen that world portrayed before in a sort of mainstream motion picture. It was widely portrayed, you know, in films that were not widely distributed before I ever made Cruising. But now we were using a big star, Al Pacino, and setting this murder mystery in this world that most people would never get a chance to see, that many people doubted even existed. And I think that a great number of people were shocked once they learned that it, of course, was an accurate portrayal of that world. But the film was not meant to be a comment about men or women who are gay. The ambiguity is something that is sort of inevitable and inherent in a film that I make, because I don't believe that things always work out for the best. I would like to believe that, but I don't like sort of pat endings. I don't mind a happy ending, but pat endings, I just can't put onto a film because I don't think they resemble life.
You're back in TV. You have a new made-for-TV movie, which airs on Monday on NBC, Cat Squad, Python Wolf. And what's the difference between doing something for the big screen and something for the little screen? Because I think we tend to think of television as a lesser medium. And I think with a television audience, you have their body, but I'm not sure you have their soul the way you might in a movie theater.
That's a, you know, Marty, that's obviously an interesting and it's probably a widely shared observation. There are many more distractions in the home, you know, including other channels for people who are watching television.
And sick babies and telephones and everything like that.
But when you look at the vast majority of motion pictures made today, how are you going to get people's souls, you know, with movies like Casual Sex, you know, or yet another movie about four teenagers making out in the back seat of a car, or, you know, the kind of 10-year-old fantasies that abound in motion picture theaters. I think that though there's much more shown on television than, you know, it's a 24-hour-a-day medium, I think there are quite a few more worthwhile things being done, and always were. I started as a live television director.
I know you were quite a young man.
In the 60s in Chicago. If live television, live dramatic television was still around, I would still be in that medium because I love the medium. I think it's great. I love the idea of trying to reach a great many people in their homes and hold their attention. And if you will, try and wrestle with their souls a little bit. But still, you know, not have a story that is strangled by its theme either, but that holds up as a work of dramatic action adventure. And that's what the Cat Squad attempts to be anyway. I don't look at it as a come down. I mean, Steven Spielberg did a television series. He's certainly the most successful filmmaker this country's ever had. Alfred Hitchcock is best known to the public for his television series. In Europe, I think the finest filmmakers all work in television. I know Fellini does. And in England, the finest writers and directors work for television as well as the stage and films. There is a perception here, though, that it's less than a theatrical. One reason for that is because, frankly, you make less money working in television as a director than you do when you direct a feature film. So agents and people like that are sort of against it, you know, against you doing it. But I love the medium. I would like to be able to do better work in the medium. It's a great challenge.
Well, I regret to say that we're out of time, and I thank you very much, William Friedkin, for talking with us this afternoon.
It was a pleasure, Marty. Thank you.
My guest has been the Academy Award-winning film director William Friedkin, whose films include The Exorcist, The French Connection, and To Live and Die in L.A. His latest work, a made-for-TV action-adventure film, airs on NBC this Monday night. It's titled Cat Squad, Python Wolf. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with baseball great Willie Mays. I hope you can join me.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross. Coming up, they say a dog is a man's best friend, but is the feeling mutual? If anyone knows, it's probably Alan Beck. He's the director of the University of Pennsylvania's Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society. We'll talk with Dr. Beck. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the cast recording of Nixon in China. And we'll hear from truck driver turned blues singer Moses Rasko. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
Green. President Reagan says illegal drug use is the foremost concern of the country, and today called for a bipartisan task force to address the issue. At the same time, the administration has given the strongest indication yet that it's ready to drop drug charges against Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega. The president delivered the commencement address to the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from New London, Connecticut.
The president said the task force, to be made up of representatives from Congress and the administration, should agree on solutions for every area of the drug problem. After touring a Coast Guard cutter that has been on several drug interdiction patrols, the president said his administration's policy is one of zero tolerance for illegal drugs.
So when we say no to drugs, it'll be clear that we mean absolutely none. No exceptions.
But the administration seems ready to make one exception for Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega, who is facing 15 drug-related charges. White House Chief of Staff Howard Baker said today, if the indictments against Noriega can be used, in Baker's words, to get rid of Noriega, they should be. The strongest indication yet that the administration might drop the charges against Noriega in return for his stepping down from power. I'm Brian Naylor with the president in New London, Connecticut.
The Senate today defeated the first attack against the medium-range missile treaty with the Soviet Union. By a vote of 91-6, senators turned down an effort by Republican Jesse Helms to stop debate on the pact, claiming Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev was not authorized to sign it. Earlier, a dispute broke out over whether future administrations may reinterpret the pact. That debate could delay ratification of the accord until after the upcoming Moscow summit. French Prime Minister Michel Rocard today said France would restore diplomatic relations with Iran. The decision follows the release of three French hostages in Lebanon. In Paris, Lynn Terry has more.
Prime Minister Rocard said the former French government, led by Jacques Chirac, had promised to restore relations in exchange for Iran's help in securing the release of the hostages. Rocard said his government, which was formed last week following the presidential elections, had found no written promise, but said it was important France keep its word. The hostages were freed this month just before the presidential elections between Jacques Chirac and Socialist President François Mitterrand, who was reelected. The timing of the release raised questions about a deal between France and Iran to help Chirac's candidacy. Chirac, though, said no deal or ransom had been paid to Tehran. However, right after the release, Chirac's government said it was repaying part of a $1 billion debt to Tehran. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The FBI is investigating a failed plot to embezzle $70 million from the First National Bank of Chicago. Seven people in Detroit and Chicago have been charged in the scheme, which involved a series of computerized cash transfers to bank accounts in Vienna. Officials at the First National Bank of Chicago credit their own security system with helping to foil the embezzlement. They say no losses are expected to the bank or its customers. Chicago's First National Bank is the 10th largest in the nation. To resign now would be an admission of guilt. Attorney General Edwin Meese reportedly made that statement today during a closed-door luncheon with conservative Republican senators on Capitol Hill. Congressional sources told the Associated Press of Meese's remarks. They came 2 days after it was disclosed the attorney general had fired his conservative chief spokesman last week, allegedly for not defending Meese aggressively enough amid continuing investigations of the attorney general by an independent counsel. Housing construction was up 0.5% last month. It was the third monthly gain in a row. And stock prices fell to a three-month low on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 35 points to close at 1951.09 on volume of 209 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. few contemporary operas have received as much attention as Nixon in China. It's been performed at the Houston Grand Opera, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and the Kennedy Center. It's been shown on television and attacked in People magazine. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new original cast recording of the opera.
I love the idea of Nixon in China, an American opera with an important American subject. As Walter Cronkite said in his introduction to the recent PBS telecast, if there are operas about kings, czars, and pharaohs, why not an opera about a president of the United States? The title itself suggests a mixture of the witty heroics of Handel's Julius Caesar in Egypt and the buffoonery of Rossini's two comedies of cross-cultural misunderstanding, The Turk in Italy and The Italian Girl in Algiers. Nixon in China focuses on the most glorious moment in the career of one of our most inglorious presidents. Composer John Adams, librettist Alice Goodman, and director Peter Sellers, who first suggested this subject, have struck an impressive balance between humanizing and satirizing their hero and the opera's other key characters, Pat Nixon, Zhou Enlai, Mao Zedong, and his wife Zheng Qing. Only Henry Kissinger remains a caricature. Yet all these larger-than-life public personages shrink in the tidal wave of history that engulfs them. This turns out to be very moving. Zhou Enlai sings at the end, "We fight, we die, and if we do not fight, we die." The young American cast is amazing. James Maddalena gives a stunning impersonation of Richard Nixon. 8 years ago, he sang Don Giovanni in Peter Sellers' first opera production. It's almost inconceivable that the same performer could portray such opposite roles. As Nixon, he reveals the dark pathos of Nixon's inner life, his obsessions, his bewildered paranoia, his naivete, his shrewdness, his dogged self-absorption.
History,
Carol Ann Page doesn't have Maddalena's vocal weight, but she too is extremely poignant as the unloved Pat. John Dykers is the powerfully inscrutable and all too politically scrutable Mao. Trudy Ellen Craney makes something terrifying out of the shrill coloratura she is given to sing as Zheng Qing. And Sanford Sylvan's Zhou Enlai is the philosophical still center, noble and wise and resigned.
I am old and cannot sleep forever like the young. Hope that death will be a novelty, not endless wakefulness.
When I saw Nixon in China on stage, I was most impressed by the production, the singers, and the libretto. This new recording, however, makes a strong argument for the music. Conductor Ato DeVart gets brilliant results from the chorus and the wonderful orchestra of St. Luke's. The words and textures emerge with eloquent clarity. Adams's minimalism is colorful, touching at times, and gripping. Its insistent repetitions are like musical Morse code bulletins from the front. But it can also get strained and monotonous. The long meeting scene between Mao and Nixon gets tedious. The music can't seem to bend to the complexities of political discussion, the way Verdi's can, for example, in King Philip's scene with the Grand Inquisitor in Don Carlo. I wish there was more room for the vein of moving lyricism that finally emerges in the last scene, when the characters are left alone to ponder both the day and their own life histories from their inevitably isolated beds.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the original cast recording of Nixon in China on the Nonesuch label. This is Fresh Air. Pets are a part of more than half of the households in the United States. For many people, they're considered members of the family. They're a source of companionship and amusement. Alan Beck studies how animals and people live together. He's director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society at the University of Pennsylvania. The center was started in 1979, but Beck's own interest in animals began much earlier. As a kid growing up in Brooklyn, New York, he used to go to the city dump to watch the rats.
It fascinated me. It was the one animal population you could see in its normal habitat, natural habitat, behaving normally. And it was just, I'm not even sure if my mother knew I was doing that, just to watch. And I was picking up some ideas of animal behavior. It's also one of the few places you can go being in the middle of a dump by yourself and just be left alone.
And you wanted that?
It was my idea of the country.
It's the dump. One of the things that you did, I guess, and this was for your doctoral thesis, was you studied the stray dog packs in Baltimore.
Right.
And this turned out to be really groundbreaking work. Why was that so?
When I was offered a doctoral program at Hopkins in Baltimore, they did a lot of field work using animals as sort of population models for human problems. It's a school of public health. And I wanted to study sort of wolves. I thought that was the thing to do in the early 70s. And just a few weeks before I moved to Baltimore, my major professor called me and said, the wolf study is a great idea, but the money is a little short. So why don't you study the dogs of Baltimore and make believe they're wolves? I thought he was a nut. I was terribly disappointed. And all my teachers at Cal State, where I was at the time, said, that's a brilliant idea. As far as they knew, there was nothing ever done with the urban dog. And they were right. So I moved to Baltimore and walked the streets of Baltimore, making believe I was out in Minnesota in the woods following wolves. And, of course, dogs are much easier to study than wolves because wolves, at the slightest scent of humans, change their behavior. Dogs are so used to having people in alleyways and walking streets. I mean, we are part of their environment. And it's one of the few animals you can study without changing their behavior at all. And dogs are, because they're so approachable, they're all so different. You don't need radio telemetry. You don't need helicopters. You can do it all in a VW. And by using a camera with even just a medium-length lens, I could photograph every animal and re-identify them just from their picture. I didn't have to capture them and mark them. And about halfway through the study, I was asked to give a paper at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS, because they were doing the first ever major seminar on urban ecology. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I'm only halfway through. He says, doesn't matter. You're the only one with urban data. It was just being at the right place at the right time. The scientific community sort of woke up to the idea that cities were environments worthy of study, had animals in them, had people in them, plants, and that there was a biological community that was unstudied, except from just the human point of view.
Well, what kind of a life do stray dogs, not just in Baltimore, but in any city, live?
You know, true stray dogs are probably less, not probably, I believe, are much less of a problem for people as a public health problem than loose pets.
In terms of attacking people?
Right. The stray dog, like a wild dog or a wild animal, will leave you alone. I mean, follow animal control officers as I do, the dog catchers around. They have to really work to catch stray dogs.
Yeah.
They're trying to escape. It's the loose pet that has now covered enough territory to keep public space as if it's part of its territory that will attack the letter carrier, the child on the bike. Mm. The wild dogs don't do that.
I have the feeling that when you talk about animals and that your interest in animals is very democratic, that you like them and respect them all equally, whether it's the rats in the dumps of Brooklyn or stray dogs or dogs that are owned by people.
I do. I suppose that's true. In fact, one of the reasons in my own research, we've gone beyond dogs and now looking at what people do with cats and exotic animals and birds, is because I feel that in an urban area, if everybody starts owning dogs, we're going to get into trouble. I don't think these other smaller critters have been given enough credit.
I get that feeling.
Dogs have good press, probably because of the animal food companies, but they've been well represented. There have not been enough animal heroes of snakes and rats and hamsters and even birds now finally getting some, given some credit.
Well, I do think that most people are very sentimentally attached to their pets, and I think it's like their attachment to their children, which is, of course, their pets are the best.
Sure.
Where do you think our passion about animals comes from?
Boy, that's a good question. Why? There are very few things as pervasive as animal ownership. I don't know of any culture now on Earth that doesn't keep pet animals. They vary from species to species. I mean, in New Guinea, they keep pigs the way we keep dogs. But there's always some affection. And I'm not sure of all the reasons. One theory proposed by behaviorist Conrad Lorenz, the Nobel laureate, and others, is that animals, especially the pet animals, really release in us our maternal instincts and paternal instincts, our nurturance, because it's definitely released in both men and women. And so if you look at the infantile forms of almost all the birds and mammals, people will ooh and ah, regardless of what the adult looks like. A dog, by the way, I mean, the selection of dogs over the probably some 15,000 years since people started living in cities has been towards the maintenance of almost puppy behaviors throughout its adult life.
What are the physiological effects of living with dogs, or living with house pets?
The first major physiological effect was the epidemiologic observation of Aaron Katcher and Erica Friedman, who I joined as soon as I came to Penn. They were studying the social support mechanisms of survival after a heart attack. Well, it turns out that animal owners holding other things constant, like severity of the heart attack, which is obviously the biggest predictor of one-year survival, and age, that is the time when the cardiac crisis occurred, holding those things constant, it turns out that animal owners have about a 3-4% higher survival than non-owners.
Is that significant?
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't sound like very much, but when you think of 500 or 600,000 people every year getting heart attacks, it is significant. And as a variable, it was statistically significant. It's not a major. I mean, it's not enough to say that animals prevent heart attack. It just means it was the first evidence that animal ownership per se is a life event that should be included in understanding human welfare. And much of our research afterward is both been at epidemiological level as looking at populations and in the laboratory. It turns out that interacting with animals drops your blood pressure, lowers your blood pressure. Touching, even aggressively stroking an animal and even talking to an animal gives you a lower blood pressure than resting.
Well, one of the things you've done is to videotape people talking with their animals. And in certain ways, I think that it seems almost like a violation of some very intimate kind of a moment.
You know, it's really amazing, and we should explain it. This is not even done with one-way mirrors. We're all in the room. It's not candid camera. There's absolutely no illusion as to what we're doing. We're standing 5-10 feet in front of the person with a video camera with the machine right there. And as soon as they start talking to the animal, they're lost. They will talk in a higher pitch, softer volume, with pauses for answers, or they'll supply the answer. Do you want to go home? Okay, we'll go home soon. We're having some linguistics now, analyzing the tapes, and you find a familiar speech pattern all of a sudden. They actually drop from formal or more formal English to real casual familiar language with animals.
Well, I mean, you can't have a conversation with your dog.
Well, you can have a conversation with yourself through your dog, and that's probably one of the big benefits of animal ownership. This is probably important for those people who really need to confide, to hear things that can only be said in confidence out loud. About 99% of people talk to dogs. The other 1% lied. We have never found anyone who doesn't talk to dogs. About 48% of adults confide in their dog, but about 70% of adolescents confide in the dog.
Hmm. And it's interesting because many adolescents feel they can't talk to their parents.
Right.
Are they talking to their dogs?
They're talking to the dog. Hmm. And like the good therapist, it's nodding, it's supportive. No matter what terrible thing you're sharing, it won't betray you. And it's nice to know that you can say those things, see how they sound, think them through without losing a friend.
Well, I want to thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
My pleasure.
Alan Beck is the director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society at the University of Pennsylvania. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with host Renee Montaigne and see what's coming up. Hi, Renee.
Hi.
What do you have for us?
Well, the president today spoke at the Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut, and he pointed to illegal drugs as the foremost problem facing the country. Yet, even while Reagan was speaking, the president's chief of staff came the closest yet to saying that the administration would drop drug charges against Panama's General Manuel Noriega. Also tonight, we'll have a discussion on a 100-year-old law called Posse Comitatus that bans the military from getting involved in law enforcement, and that's, of course, being talked about by Congress right now. And a debate over mashed potatoes tonight, lumps or no lumps.
Great. Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Blues singer and guitarist Moses Rasko has picked up a lot of songs on the road. For over 40 years, he made his living driving a truck cross-country and always took his guitar along. He joins us today with a song about a city on the Mississippi.
Now I'm going to try a little bit of the St. Louis blues. I know I don't play it like the other people play it. I just picked up my way of playing it. And that's the way I learned it, and I think I'll just stick with it. I started trying to change it around. I might add too much, might take away too much. So I'm going to just play for you the way I want, like I play it, not the way the other people play it. Lord, I got the St. Louis blues, blue as I can. Lord, I got the St. Louis blues, woman, blue as I can be. Lord, that woman got a heart, mama, like a rock in the deep blue sea. I'm going down to the river, take my rocking. I'm going down to the river, little woman, take my rocking chair. That's where the blues all take me, baby, on. Rock on, wave him, yeah. Love the steamboat up the river, turning round and love that steamboat up the river, turning round and round. That's where it don't strike deep water, that boat will never land. Well, the mighty Mississippi, so long, deep, and Lord, that muddy Mississippi River, so long, deep, and wide. I swear I can tell my woman clean on the other side. Lord, the St. Louis woman wears a diamond. Lord, that St. Louis woman wears a diamond ring. That's where she leads her man round by her apron string.
Moses Rasko's album called Blues is on the Flying Fish label. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Mal Sharp. For years, armed with only a tape recorder and microphone, Sharp has been stopping total strangers on the street, asking them ridiculous questions and recording their bewildered, often hilarious responses. We'll also have a review of Love Sexy, the new album from Prince, and a review of Colors, the new film about big city gang violence. It stars Sean Penn and Robert Duvall. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Vablitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.